Everyone.
And I want to thank you both for the contributions you've made. I really learned a lot and benefited a great deal. I think that what I would like to try and do is add some context to some of the issues coming up, including why some of the factors you were hoping would take hold perhaps can in a different environment. And in particular, I'd really like to talk about strategy. I'd like to talk about what we can do to start to really engage in making a difference. And I should say, by way of background, Prevention Institute's a nonprofit that's really designed to be a focal point for community thinking on prevention generally. We, like you, have arrived at the conclusion that you can't do prevention work without paying particular attention to violence, because violence affects where we live, where we work, whether we work, whether it's safe, whether we walk, has huge impacts on chronic disease, et cetera, et cetera. That being said, a lot of our work at Prevention Institute is on street violence. And our largest project with Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is called Unity. And Unity is a project to try and make our communities safer. We're quite clear that without new money, but with the change in investment and priorities, we could reduce the violence in cities by about 50% right away and sustain that. That being said, we felt it's very important that a mayor, if he's going to be challenged on violence, is almost always going to be on street violence. But we felt it was very important to look at what goes on in families at the same time that we look at communities. And I hope what I'll show you is some of the findings where the two were linked. Basically, we went to the Ms. Magazine Foundation, and we asked for some funding to bring some people together to think together about what could be done to start to transform communities, as the title said, so that we start to prevent child sexual abuse. Watching CNN this morning in my hotel room, there was this raid. There were 86 people arrested, 14 children saved, I believe were the numbers, or maybe it was 186 people arrested. And it was described as this astounding success. And frankly, unless we get to the prevention in the first place, and start to talk about what we're going to do, a criminal justice strategy alone just ain't going to do it. So the initiative that we brought together from Ms. Foundation was to prioritize prevention strategies, to really analyze what's going on in the environment, and most importantly, to say, how do we start to have traction by looking at policies and looking at community practices. Christine, who put together these slides for me, said, you know, this is what happens if you Google the word girls on Google. And most of the pictures are pretty limited in their roles, and in most cases, pretty insulting. And so if this is what girl is supposed to be, there might be a link between that and some of the sexualization issues that we see. You know, current perception of child sexual abuse and exploitation. We've got Dateline, we've got To Catch a Predator, we've got all these different snapshots. The man is always the perpetrator. A lot of attention now to this term sexting, because everybody likes the next new thing. So what are we going to do? Child pornography charges for teens. You know, a felony pornography charge for a minor, you know, for texting back and forth. This statement from one of our participants in our convening, there must be an increased awareness that child sexual abuse and exploitation does not occur in isolation, but instead stems from deeply rooted social inequities and environmental influences. So if that is the case, and I think I'll show you some thinking about why it's the case, it requires a social inequities, environmental influence strategy, not an individual arrest the perpetrator strategy. So let's just take a look at the environment, and particularly the new millennium, where I would argue that things are even worse, more and more sophisticated marketing toward children. You know, this whole pervasive use of technology, sexualization. The sister of a well-known actress on the left. She's 14 years old. Sky Vodka ad. you know, dolls, you know, this is what we're seeing. And of course, at the same time, there's lack of resources to support people after they've already been abused, or for abusers to see that the abuse is going to stop. And we have to see this all in an equity context. We have to see this where we're facing increased concentration of poverty at this point. Nearly half of men would be too scared to help a child in need because they feared being branded a pedophile. 44% would be wary of coming to the aid of youngsters in case they were suspected of attempting to abduct them. So we've basically got an environment, a system that's really, really kind of gone awry. And so I want to remind you that prevention, the key word when I think of prevention is systematic. You know, that it's not giving people information, it's not certainly not holding health fairs or telling people, you know, six-year-olds what to do when attacked. It's really creating a systematic process and really looking at how we change the environment. And of course, everyone's familiar with the notion of a continuum of prevention, but I'm particularly interested in what we can do before the violence occurs, how we start to change our communities, change our norms, so that that makes a difference. This is obviously a much harder problem than any of those, but I was involved in each of these three issues. I did the country's first no smoking, multi-city no smoking laws. I was involved in lead poisoning a little bit, and I was involved in the laws to require infant seats and car seats. With tobacco, I got a call from a colleague, and what he said was, Larry, you're crazy. You know, look at the money in the tobacco industry. And in fact, the very next day, the head of the tobacco lobby sat down with me over lunch and tried to bribe me in some rather appealing ways. It's in all, tobacco's in all the movies, you'll never make change. And the kind of change we made, 40% of a restaurant, you know, being no smoking, and we could see a room like this, we got the smokers on one side, the non-smokers on the other, and you say, is that really going to do anything about cancer or heart disease? We know the ventilation systems will blow the smoke back and forth. Of course it won't do anything about it, and of course it did, because basically what we did was start the momentum of norms change and really started something that seemed imprecise, maybe not even exactly right, and certainly insufficient. And over time, the momentum built up. Same thing, that's Britney Spears there, I believe, in her driving. No, that's not Britney Spears. But that's someone with a child on her lap. When people knew one generation ago that it wasn't safe to have their infants on their, in their hands or on their laps, less than 1 out of 4 in any state in the United States used infant car seats. When we passed the law to change the policy, I would say the policy became the tipping factor for the norms change. And now pretty much 99, 100% infant car seat utilization, and the notion that anything else is child abuse. It's inappropriate. And so by changing the norm, by changing the environment, we can have that kind of impact. Lead's yet another example, but I don't really have the time to go into it now. But the point I want to make is that every single one of these issues was hard. Every single one of these issues was complicated. We had industry opposing us in a number of cases. And I think we can start to look at this notion of norms change, this focus then on the environment, you know, on particularly traditional gender norms and norms supportive of violence. And it really is based on what D.H. Lawrence says, that if we can change the ideas of one generation, they become the instincts of the next, because norms shape behaviors. They shape the way we deal with things. For me, the term, if I look at all the terms up here, behavior shapers is the one that's most important. And so what we talked about here, and I want to say that these five key norms of limited roles for women, power over, the very narrow definition of manhood, violence is the ways that we solve our problem, and perhaps most importantly, the norm of privacy, the norm of silence, the norm of it's better to stay away, it's none of my business, there's nothing I'm going to do about it, it's not my personal issue. Those are the kinds of norms that then shape the entire community environment. These norms, by the way, were developed in work we did on family violence and on sexual violence with adults. And then we talked about them with child abuse, and then we talked about them with child sexual assault, always bringing together leaders in those communities. And to my surprise, they pretty much said, more or less, these are the five same norms. And we have a key then that by changing these norms, we can start to have an impact and stop the norm of sexualized childhood. Stop the norm that we take it for granted, because it's unreasonable to expect people are going to change their behaviors easily, even if we arrest 180 people and it's on TV every 6 months. It's unreasonable we're going to change behavior easily when so many forces in the social, cultural, and physical environment conspire about such change. So what do we do about it? And the tool that I developed a long time ago for a video called Beyond Brochures, the Spectrum Prevention, talks about multiple levels of strategy. It talks about working in different ways at the same time and the synergy, building the catalyzing from one level to the next. But as you can see, the higher levels, policy change, organizational practice change, are thicker because we can have broader impact in those kinds of ways. So Jean Kilbourne did this book called Killing Us Softly, where she talked about the ways that advertising portrays women. And then she recently did another book called So Sexy So Soon, about how difficult it is to even go shopping for clothing and not get sexualized clothing for 6-year-old, 7-year-old, 8-year-old. She wrote the book from the experience of shopping with her own daughter and saying, wait a minute, it's not just some hip, fancy boutique that has one set of sexualized clothing. I imagine many of you who are parents of young children know this much, much better than me. Community education, of course, is important. This is aimed, obviously, at somewhat older teens. My strength is not for hurting. But we know that education is not just through media, but it's getting people to do things differently. So this is a range of providers that we reached out to, the schools reaching out to media, getting librarians to think about this, getting healthcare providers to ask different questions. But the questions we want people to ask are not just questions to uncover abuse after it occurs. They're really to talk about health. They're really to talk about the resilience factors. And I believe that if we can put a set of factors together, we'll get more tipping toward the factors that you described than if we just look for any one of them alone or any two of them alone in a community which is completely unfriendly to that kind of resilience and is fighting every step we're taking. The notion, of course, of a network. These were the recommendations, kind of in quick and dirty photos to, you know, kind of keep you interested and entertained in a brief overview. The notion of a jigsaw puzzle. I love the notion of the jigsaw puzzle because each of the groups can be doing important work, but when we put it together, we can have a greater level of clout. We can make much broader changes. Things that seem impossible just turn out to take a while to do, but are very, very doable. So there are prioritized strategies that they talked about on the community and the state level, like organizing coalitions with representatives from multiple disciplines. So we weren't just talking about justice, we weren't just talking about health, we were talking about media, we were talking about the hotel industry. On the national level, a rapid response media network so that we start to spread prevention messages. An example of this is work we were doing where we said we can't just stand by while we listen to male sports talk hosts basically as misogynists attacking and sexualizing women all the time. And then when Don Imus made his creepy remarks, we spread that word all over the country. And very, very quickly, there was response, I'm sure, not just from us spreading it, but really for many, many different reasons. And Don Imus was off the air. That's the way that we try and change our norms. That's the way we try and change our environments. The Source is a magazine that promotes positive messages about children, positive messages about sexuality. Here's So Sexy, So Soon. The notion of incorporating prevention into current policy, but also we've got to hold industry accountable. And we need to start to have mandates for our prevention efforts. And finally, on the spectrum, the notion of policy and legislation. We've got the Department of Justice releasing its national strategy for child exploitation prevention. It happened a couple of months ago. We worked on the Healthy Media for Youth Act. The important thing is really, and I think I'm just giving you a taste of strategy here and how it can relate to norms, the important thing is to focus on synergy. That when we get the pieces working together, when we build momentum, we can start to create the kind of environmental change which is not only possible, but is necessary. As my dear colleague said, Dr. Deborah Prothero-Stith, violence is not the problem of one neighborhood or group. Coming together and owning this problem, as opposed to standing by, as opposed to saying it's none of my business, coming together and owning the problem and creating together the solutions. That's what's really, really essential. So let me just say before I end, because I've covered a lot of stuff really, really quickly, additional tools. We just came out with the second edition of our textbook, Prevention is Primary. We're actually doing a book signing today, which would be, they're usually very quiet events, so come by and say hello. But we really want a new generation that gets the notion of primary prevention, and this is on our website. Of course, it's free. Feel free to print it at any time. In terms of the adult issue, and I don't think we can separate the adult issue, the Physician's Guide to Intimate Partner Violence and Abuse was a reference for healthcare professionals, and to my shock, I found out there wasn't a chapter on primary prevention. And I ran into the author when she was rewriting it, and I said, who wrote the chapter on primary prevention? And she said, well, there is none. And I said, Pat Salver, that's unacceptable. And so she called us up and asked us to write it. And so the chapter also is free on our website. Another document, Sexual Violence and the Spectrum Prevention. You know, it's basically based on the spectrum, lays out solutions in much more detail than we have here. And we do a set of webcasts on a monthly basis about violence toward women and girls called Prevent Connect. The final thing I want to say is that this is a critical time right now for health reform. The new funding for health reform was, I believe, really looking, though the FOA was not announced yet, was really looking beyond the important work that went on in chronic disease in the stimulus, and was really saying, how do we build injury prevention, violence against women, violence against girls in? We've got to insist that that money get out there, and we got to insist that it's broad and inclusive, and that we're fighting one coherent, community, winnable struggle. Thank you all very much.